Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we will be speaking with Nigerian printmaker textile artist Tunde Odunlade, and we'll be speaking with encaustic artist Russell Thurston. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Yoav Potash. He is producer and director of the documentary Crime After Crime, which opens here in Santa Fe at the CCA Cinematheque starting on Thursday, the 11th of August, a week from today. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Pleasure to be back.
So this is a story about a woman named Deborah Piegler. She spent over 25 years in jail. Tell us her story.
Well, Deborah Piegler, when she was 15 years old, living in South Central Los Angeles, she met a man who seemed charming and sweet and nice, and he took her out on dates and, you know, really was quite a gentleman and was very intelligent, and she fell for him. And then he changed the game on her one night and basically asked her to prostitute herself for his financial gain, and it was all part of a sort of a story that he was saying, I'm just ran out of cash, and you just need to do this for me one time. And she actually refused, and when she did refuse, he really beat her up, and eventually he forced her to prostitute herself, and this went on for years, and she tried to get away, and eventually sought the protection of a couple of tough guys in that area, and they ended up killing Oliver Wilson, the man who she had originally fallen in love with and who turned out to be a pimp and a batterer. And so she was sentenced to life in prison after Oliver Wilson was killed. And 20 years later, two relatively young attorneys fresh out of law school volunteer to try to fight to get Deborah out of prison. And really, so all of that is kind of the backstory of where my film takes off from.
Now, you got involved because one of the attorneys was a friend of yours. How did the two attorneys, Joshua Safran and Nadia Costa, get involved and find out about Debbie's story?
California is the only state right now that has a law that allows incarcerated victims of domestic violence to go back to the court and say, you know what, when you sent me to prison, you didn't know about the abuse that I was suffering. And so along with that law being passed, an organization formed called the Habeas Project, which is very similar to the Innocence Project, which a lot of people have heard of.
Yeah.
Has to do with, you know, using DNA evidence to get people out of prison who shouldn't be there.
And other kinds of evidence.
Yes. And the Habeas Project is essentially the same thing. They focus on domestic violence evidence. And it's currently just in California because that's the only place where the law exists. But these two young attorneys heard about the Habeas Project, were contacted by them because, just like the Innocence Project, they need attorneys, they need law firms to donate some time to try to work these cases. So it was really just sort of dumb luck or fate that put Joshua and Nadia together with Deborah. And I really think, you know, it was a great match for them. Their chemistry, their synergy, and their common experience really bonded them and gave them the strength to handle this kind of a marathon case.
Both of them, just as an aside, had some experience with battering in their own lives, and so they had a lot of empathy for Deborah Piegler.
That's right. You know, in the film, as you watch the film, sort of at first you just think, oh, that's nice, these two young attorneys are volunteering for this woman. And over, as you watch the film, you realize, oh, they were both victims of domestic violence, each in their own way, in their youth. And for them, it's perhaps it's healing, perhaps it's just trying to counteract a force that affected them negatively in their own lives. And I think it shows you as a viewer, as an audience member, as you're watching the film, you realize when the going gets tough in this case, these guys aren't going to give up.
Right. It is such an amazing and horrifying illustration of the reality in this country, which is still true. I mean, there's been a lot more consciousness than there was in the 1970s and 80s, but it's still true that many, many women in prison are battering domestic violence victims and people who essentially killed or hurt somebody in self-defense and went to jail for it.
That's right. That's right. It's important to remember how young the domestic violence prevention movement is as a whole. You know, 30 years ago, I don't know if our society was really in agreement that domestic violence is wrong, that hitting your wife is wrong. Today, I'm glad, I think I can say, that as a society, we generally all hold that view. Obviously, there are many exceptions, but it's taken a long time for our courts, for our police, for all of our systems to really catch up that's the reality, that's the common value that we all share, hopefully. And there's plenty of work to be done to make sure that victims of domestic violence aren't re-victimized by the system. And even though my film, Crime After Crime, presents this really harrowing uphill legal battle, I think at the same time it is inspiring because I think the story does show that progress can be made if enough people are willing to care, are willing to come together and raise their voices, and that there is momentum. In fact, the film is being shown in New York right now, and New York may well be the second state to have a law like California has. So, you know, I think a lot of times when we think about the law, we think it's fixed in stone, you know, just like the Supreme Court building itself. And it's actually more like a river that flows and that changes over time. And hopefully the course of law will continue to bring increased justice to women in general, and specifically around the issue of abuse and domestic violence.
And also to black people. I mean, she is one of thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of black people about whom the police doesn't care at all. What happened was, if I may just say a little bit of what happened in the film, before her abuser was killed, she moved out, she got away from him, she went back to her mother's house with her own children. He came with a band of armed men with guns, surrounded the house, threatened to kill everybody. The police came, took him away, and after one day let him out, didn't follow up, didn't care if she got killed. And as a result, Deborah Pegler's mother said, "Listen, we know a couple of gangsters. Why don't we have him rough this guy up so he leaves you alone?" Nobody ever intended for this abuser to die. They just wanted to rough him up pretty badly so that he wouldn't bother her anymore. She wasn't even there when he was killed, and yet she serves a life sentence.
Yeah, it is pretty appalling. There's no doubt about it. And certainly the fact that Deborah Pegler is an African-American woman, you know, does not help her in the system. Unfortunately, it tends to only hurt people who are accused of crimes if they're black. You know, statistically, of course, they have a worse time off. They're convicted more often and they're sentenced more harshly. That said, going to prison, seeing these women who are serving life sentences, I saw white women, I saw black women, I saw women of all colors and all ages as well. And I think the system as a whole is really not treating female victims of domestic violence fairly, thoughtfully. And in part that's because, you know, there's a lot of male bias in the system that's been there for a long time, and that takes a lot of hard work and a lot of continued concerted effort for it to change. But, you know, one thing I do want to say about Deborah is that she didn't let any of that get her down. You know, as she's serving,
which is unbelievable.
Yeah. As she's serving a life sentence, she is leading the gospel choir in the prison. She's teaching illiterate inmates to read and write. She's earning college degrees herself from behind bars. She's also working the highest paid job available to an inmate in the California prison system. So all of that is part of the film and is part of, I think, what really helps make the film, not as dark and depressing as it could be, given that it is about wrongful incarceration. It is about domestic violence, at least in terms of the backstory. And yet, Deborah herself, as well as her attorneys, I think they're all inspiring people to observe. I've seen people have this interesting mix of reactions as they watch the film. On the one hand, they are frustrated and angered by what we reveal in terms of misconduct within the justice system. And on the other hand, they're looking at people like Deborah and saying, wow, there's a lesson I can learn from my life here.
We're talking to Yoav Potash about his film Crime After Crime, which opens at the CCA a week from today, the 11th of August. And I have to say that, as you just said, it is uplifting in some ways, it's depressing in others. It is such good filmmaking. It's just unbelievable. I was riveted. I was watching the DVD that you gave me the other day on my couch. I almost couldn't breathe through the whole thing. It was so good. And it has such a narrative and so many characters whom you love and a couple of villains whom you hate. I mean, just like any good movie. But it's real. And it says so much about the culture we live in. It says so much about what people can do under dire circumstances. It says so much about persistence and love. I mean, these two attorneys who got involved in Deborah Pegler's case, there are scenes where Deborah is weeping because these people who don't know her at all, who are complete strangers, who are not family, have become family, have given their hearts, their souls, their life. And they're much more interested in this pro bono case than they are in anything that they're doing for money.
That's right.
And there they are.
Yeah, well, you can make me cry just talking about it because it was an emotional journey, for all of us. We all became really, really tight. We all cared about one another very, very much, and the stakes got very, very high. Without giving anything away, I'll just say, the stakes became life and death again during this case. So for all of us, the emotional investment was something that became much deeper than any of us ever anticipated, and yet it was kind of one of these roads you walk down and you realize this is definitely the right road. This is where I need to be. This is what I need to be doing. And yet it's a much steeper climb than I ever would have guessed. One thing I can say that I hope doesn't give away much of the plot is just that her case becomes more and more high profile. It starts as this quiet case where these two land use attorneys, by the way, they don't have any experience in criminal law, so there's this like fish out of water element at play here. But they're volunteering. They just want to prove she was abused, go to the court, get her out, simple, over, done. And what they discover is that there was all kinds of evidence that was buried, all kinds of lies that were told just to put Deborah in prison in the first place.
Which is such an abuse of the position of prosecutor, district attorney. One gets into this position, and there's so many cases like this, and there have been other documentaries made where the DA thinks it's about winning the case as opposed to getting the truth out. And so, in order to win cases, evidence of somebody's innocence or near innocence will be suppressed. Evidence of other people's wrongdoing will be suppressed and hidden against the law.
Yep, absolutely. And I discovered how common the abbreviation CYA is within the legal world, which I don't think I ever used it very much myself, but it stands for cover your ass.
Right.
And people say that all the time, just very casually. Oh, yeah, CYA. And that's what that means. When there was a little bit of evidence that was used that probably shouldn't have been used because we knew the witness was lying, well, we'll just sort of CYA. We'll use the evidence, but we'll paper it such that After the fact, we sort of apologize internally and, whoops, we never submitted that memo to the court where we admitted that we knew the evidence was perjured, you know, and that sort of thing.
And meanwhile, somebody's life is at stake who has young children who grow up without a mother or father.
Yep, it's, you know, that is obviously, that's the side of the story that's kind of infuriating on one level. And these are our tax dollars at work. And Americans really need to take ownership of who is your district attorney, what are they doing, what's going on, are these the kind, is this the way you want your tax dollars spent? You know, do you want to spend $100,000 a year to keep a victim of domestic violence who was protecting herself and protecting her children in prison? You know?
And who didn't even do the...
That's
who
right.
didn't even commit the murder.
That's right. That's right.
Now, there was, as you say, a growing movement in the media to free Debbie, and there was a website to free Debbie, and articles were written, and that was part of what actually got her case heard. I mean, she was denied parole so many times during the course of her life, the film, that it's just shocking. I mean, it's staggering. But what did finally getting this media do for her case?
Well, I think it took it to the next level where, you know, I think finally after the district attorney made it very clear that they were going to just lie, that they weren't going to honor a deal that they had actually put forward to get Deborah out of prison in the year 2005. So after she'd been in prison for 22 years, the DA almost did the right thing. They reviewed the evidence, said, yes, she was abused, quote, in the interest of justice, she should be released. And then, for what appear to be internal political reasons, the district attorney decided not to honor that deal, that written offer. And so at that point, finally, her attorneys sort of gave me the green light to go to the media, because here I was, I had all this footage by this point and had been kind of itching to let the story out, and yet because of the rules of how cameras can get into prisons, the news couldn't actually get in and film her. I had sort of worked out my own special Trojan horse type of way to get in.
Good for you.
And so I would share my footage with the news. That got her story covered. That helped lead to a grassroots movement, such that eventually, you know, there were dozens of people marching around in downtown L.A. to try to advocate for her release. There were thousands of people sending letters and making phone calls.
There were rappers writing songs about it.
That's right, yeah. Arrested Development came into the prison and met Deborah and sang with her and her choir. So that's, you know, a scene in the film where you really see her story reaching out into the world and the world sort of reaching back all the way into the prison to heighten her story and to elevate Debbie and just offer her moral support. And, of course, the musical element of that scene and of the other scenes where we see Debbie leading that choir, it really brings something to the film that I think reinforces her character as an inspirational person. And it's, of course, just nice to have that kind of music in the film. It's really powerful to see these people, you know, singing with really full hearts from behind prison walls.
At a certain point, I, and I imagine many viewers, realize that Debbie is a person whose quality of soul is such that, of course, she wants to get, of course, she wants to be with her daughters and eventually her grandchildren, but she wants to be an example of justice so that other people don't have to suffer the way that she did.
That's right. I mean, she would say, of course, that her religion was Christianity. I would say that her religion was positivity, because that was how she would react to any situation. When there was a setback where we thought she was going to be freed and then it turned out she wasn't, of course she was disappointed. Of course she was on some level even outraged and devastated. But at the same time, within 48 hours of getting that news, she was looking at it as and saying to herself and saying to us, well, God must want me here a little while longer so that I can do some more work in here, so that I can teach another inmate to read and write, so that my story gets back in the newspapers and on the front pages and causes a ripple effect so that it'll make a bigger impact. So she was always just looking at things from like, okay, God has a plan. I don't know what it is, and sometimes God is confusing me here. I don't know why God's putting me back in prison, but God has a plan. This is all going to work out. And that's just, you know, amazing to behold.
We're talking about the film Crime After Crime. Yoav Potash, you opened this film. It premiered at Sundance Film Festival earlier this year, and you have won all kinds of prizes in many festivals around the country. It's now at the CCA. It's having a theatrical run. How have audiences responded to it, and how have you gotten the film out to the people who maybe need to see it?
Audiences have responded enthusiastically. I mean, at Sundance, we had 6 screenings. We had 6 standing ovations. So that was just amazing, humbling, something I'll never forget. And we've, as you mentioned, we've won all these awards all over the country. In San Francisco, we won both the Audience Award and the Jury Prize for Investigative Feature Documentary. So that's just amazing. And then at the same time, what I've done alongside the film is launch something called Debbie's Campaign, which is trying to use the film to maximize the impact that it can have on the justice system in particular, and also in terms of domestic violence prevention. I mean, one of the things Debbie herself said when she had the opportunity to see a rough cut version of the film was, she said, you know, if I had seen this when I was 15, maybe none of this would have had to have happened.
I know. I mean, this is the thing. I wish, you know, I wish every police man and woman in the country would see it, every judge and DA.
We're working on it.
And also girls.
Absolutely.
Because
we're working on all of it.
You're watching this whole thing and saying, Debbie, because you see these pictures of her as a beautiful teenager, and you're saying, get out now. And she doesn't.
Right. And she didn't know. She didn't know, and she, you know, she was charmed. She was dazzled by this older man who was very good-looking and intelligent.
Yeah, he was
a few years older. Yeah, not a lot older, but he was in his, I think he was probably 19, she was 15 when they met. So that's, you know, it's a significant enough gap where, you know, he's got a car, he can take her all kinds of places she's never been, and she can really fall for him. So we have shown the film at high schools, and they've responded really enthusiastically. I remember one high school in San Francisco had Deborah's daughter Natasha and Nadia, one of the attorneys, there with me, and when we all walked in, I mean, this group of teenagers, they were stunned. I don't think they had ever had the experience of seeing a movie and then seeing the real people.
Right.
And they were just so blown away. I think first they were blown away by the film itself. And I don't know if, you know, I don't know if they knew we were coming. But then we had a discussion with them, talked about what did the film mean to them. And we could tell that this was going to be for them one of those experiences that they have in high school that they will never forget, and that shapes their views on the legal system and on domestic violence and maybe just on human character in general. And some of these people will go on to become lawyers and will be able to help make a difference.
The film Crime After Crime opens at the CCA on Thursday, the 11th of August. And we should also mention it starts at the Guild Theater in Albuquerque on Friday, the 12th of August. And you will be, when will you be at the CCA?
I will be there for every evening screening starting Thursday and going through Sunday. So Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
So people can talk to the filmmaker.
That's right. I'm looking forward to it.
Yoav Potash, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome to the program Tunde Odunlade. He is an internationally acclaimed Nigerian print and textile artist, and he will be presenting his works in the Gallery Tribal Art, which is at 312 Reed Street here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So you are an artist who is very concerned both with the artistic process and the political and social place of art. Tell us about how you make those things come together.
I've always seen art as life and life as art. So by the time you put all of those together, then you discover that there is hardly anything we do that is not art inclined one way or the other. You know, and I want to say that everything we do, first you have to get the inspiration to do it, and then the ability to be able to make it real, and then which are the process by which you go through as when you are producing a piece of art. And which is, so to me, that's art is an integral part of our life.
So did you grow up in an artistic family, in an artistic town, culture?
Well, Ile Ife, my hometown, is the cradle of Yoruba race. That means all the culture that you see happen in Yoruba, wherever Yoruba are in the diaspora today, you know, originated from Ile Ife. So coming up as a young boy, we were exposed to all of this. Plus, I'm from a royal family too, so all of these we were exposed to right from when we were young. You know, the traditional dances, the traditional singing, the artistic palace posts, you know, the all the creativity that you see that makes a society cultural. We're exposed to it from the beginning.
So you do, you work with textiles and with prints. I went over there today and saw your work, and it's really beautiful.
Thank you.
It's both abstract. I mean, people probably know and can see in their minds some of the kind of African colors and patterns,
yes,
from West Africa.
Yes.
But there's also a narrative aspect to the work.
Yes. As an artist, I was trained to become an artist. And as a human being, I was endowed. You know, I'm endowed with some degree of talent in me. And I always say, it's not enough to just have talent. It's also good to have some training to help sharpen the talent. So I've got all of these for me, and I'm a kind of a person who is inquisitive, you know, and I like to have intellectual discussions, you know. And so all of this put together, you know, formed what you perhaps can see on my work. I travel around a lot. And more importantly, when I was born, the family that I was born to, and typical of Yoruba family too, you will be given what is called Oriki. I spell it O-R-I-K-I, Oriki. Oriki means praising names. The names that you are given other than your legal name, you know, that tells your origin, the clan perhaps that you are coming from, the family you are born into, and even some of what you brought to life naturally. So my Oriki says Ladire, and this was given to me on the 8th day that I was born. Ladire, Adire in Yoruba means Adire, like what she's wearing, indigo. Aladire, Apela Juma Jason, Utili Arare Ribi. Ladire means the owner or maker of Adire. Apela Juma Jason, one who goes on a sojourn and never suffers. Otili Ararerebi, one who goes on a journey prepared from his own home. Those are the Oriki given to me on my 8th day. And of course, Ladire, which is the extension of Adire, is batik, and which is what I do. So from when I was born, this was already in me.
Amazing.
What they call esentaye, that is what I've brought to life with me. But of course, somebody has to be, you have to be exposed to maybe some kind of classes or schools in order to bring that out from you. So that was when I had the opportunity to meet a Nigerian artist by the name of Yinka Adeyemi. He was recently here in Santa Fe visiting, who I studied textile under him. And of course, I've been able to also expand to other area of textile, but he was the foundation of my training as an artist. You know, so all of this put together, you know, has informed what you see on my work. I interact with people, you know, I go to museums, I go to galleries, I read, I practice on my own, and so on and so forth. And I think that's what life is all about, education.
Now, your work is, you use it both in the ways that you've been saying, and also as a form of political activism, resistance, and bringing people together around some of the trouble that has happened in Nigeria.
Yes. There's no way, if you are the type who likes to see changes, if you are the type who likes to see a better life for his people, if you are the type who just does not come to this world like a snake walking on the rock. When snake moves on the rock, after the snake has passed, would you see any sign that the snake moved on the rock? No. Any human being that comes to life and has nothing to leave behind in form of legacy, has nothing to contribute. We've been to museums today. At the Folk Art Museum, there's Gerard Alexander, if I remember well the name. You know, he collected a lot of things and left for his people. That's leaving something behind and leaving a trail, you know, after, you know, some time. So, in the same vein, I feel like I cannot fold my arms. I cannot close my eyes to things around me that I see, that I feel the tool in my hand, the weapon in my hand, which is art, I can use to change things for the better.
And so how do you do that?
How I do it is, I respond to whatever it's around me. You know, I respond, I'm such a person that when I hear a word in my ear or I see anything, it goes straight into my brain. And I won't let go until I process it and come to a conclusion that this thing that I've had or that I've known, this is the way out to it. This is what I can do to make it better in my head. You know, I won't just hear something that my head says, that my head clicks, and I will just let go of that thing. So all of this put together, seeing my environment, the way things are going, seeing the kind of government that we have at one time or another, especially the military days, you know, and seeing what is happening now, that the people desire every change they can get to better their lot. And I have this weapon in my hand, which is art. So I don't believe in art for art's sake. I believe in art with a purpose in nation building.
We're talking to artist Tunde Odunlade from Nigeria. Now, tell us about the relationship between your work and Yoruba culture, art, music, philosophy, all of that.
Wow. Yoruba language is one of the languages on earth that is full of codes, that is full of symbols, that is full of proverbs. Some have argued that there are over 5,000 proverbs in Yoruba. I know it's way more than that. So, the philosophy of the Yoruba, the substance that makes Yoruba who they are, is inched on the language. And every sphere of life, everything in life, has a meaning traceable to a Yoruba proverb. Everything we do has a greeting. When you are work, there is greeting for work. When you are eating, there is greeting for eating. When you are working, there is greeting for working. Everything you do has a greeting with it. So in the same vein, everything has a proverb to go along with it. And I thank my star to have been somebody who is very rooted in that language. I speak Yoruba language real well. You know, ordinarily, it's not everybody who understands all the nuances, all the intricacies, all the philosophy underlying in Yoruba language. You don't just know it because you are a Yoruba person. No. You know it either out of interest or out of where you were born or who, how you were raised or what you have allowed yourself to be exposed to. And all of that put together has made me who I am, who has his work centered on the beliefs, the philosophy, and then the proverbs of Yoruba language.
Give us just an example of a proverb.
Okay. A proverb, for instance, could be like, Didun lodun, labore jeko, tili ogeto geje. That is, it is when friendship is good that you and I can say, let's go to dinner. And then we go to dinner, we eat together, and then we enjoy the meal. But if we are not friends, our heart is not open to each other, you don't just see a stranger on the street and say, oh, let's go eat. Right? But it has to be that you have some form of relationship together, some form of camaraderie together that will prompt, you know, inviting each other to go to dinner. So it is because there is that sweetness between us, there is that sweet relationship that prompts eating together. Otherwise, I could go to my house and eat whatever I like, you go to your house and eat whatever you like, and that's it. Last year, I was hosted by University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA, you know, to do some presentation on Yoruba, which I call ABD Olowe, the ABC of Proverbs. You know, and what I will do is take a letter, then form a proverb in Yoruba, then give it a translation close as possible in Yoruba language, in English, of the proverb, then find something that is similar to it in other culture, maybe in English or in Japanese, that can enable whoever reading to understand where it's coming from, the universal meaning or translation of that, and then bring out the morale, the lesson in the proverb, you know. So I did that with UCLA and it was very successful. And I'm going to continue to do it, of course, wherever the opportunity presents itself.
Tunde Odunlade is going to be showing his work at the Gallery Tribal Art on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And it's open from 12 until 6 p.m. every day. And I have to say, it's a wonderful gallery. Maybe some people even who live here have missed it, but it's on 312 Reed Street. So it's just less than a block off of Guadalupe. The number there is 699-7810. And your work is just beautiful and fascinating. And
thank
so
you.
I hope people get to go over there and check it out. Thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You're welcome.
We're going to take another quick break. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe on KSFR. I'd like now to welcome to the program Russell Thurston. He is an encaustic artist, and he has a show that is opening tomorrow at Vivo Contemporary at 725 Canyon Road. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So encaustic, that is a medium that I am going to guess most of our listeners have not heard of, or even if they have, they don't know what it is.
Well, the word encaustic is Greek, and it means to burn in. And the ancient Greeks and the Egyptians were the first to start using encaustic, and it's basically beeswax and damar resin. And what the Egyptians started doing was funerary masks. There's a very famous series of paintings called the Fayoum portraits, where they painted the portrait of the person that was mummified and attached it to the outside of the mummy. And then the Greeks used it. They would coat their ships with it to waterproof the wood hull. And then they started painting elaborate designs on the ships with it. So it dates back thousands of years. I think the earliest painting that they found was about 100 AD.
You make this stuff yourself. So you take beeswax and resin, you melt it over a griddle.
Right.
You add pigment.
Of course, the Egyptians didn't have electric pancake griddles, but I use a portable electric griddle and some old muffin tins, and I mix up the damar resin and the beeswax, and you can either put in oil sticks or oil paints or dry pigments to get the color.
And so once you do that, you've got a molten medium that as soon as you paint it on, it dries.
Right. The working time is really short. When you use it, a bristle brush, you have to use a natural bristle brush because the nylon brushes and sable brushes and the expansion brushes don't hold up to the heat.
So they'll just melt in the muffin.
Yeah, the little hairs just fall apart. So I just buy really cheap bristle brushes from the hardware store and use them. But when you take the brush out of the hot liquid encaustic medium and apply it, you only have about 10 or 15 seconds of working time. So you can either work really quickly or just work in very small little brush strokes. But there are companies now, because of the popularity of encaustic, companies like R&F and Encausticos that make special tools that allow you to have a longer working time. Bristles, brushes that have brass bristles that you can screw into a heat tool and various tips that you can change. So it allows you to have a little more working time, a little more flexibility.
It's so interesting that people are working in these really ancient media that are basically materials found. If all of society evaporated, you could still do this stuff. You'd still have access to resin, beeswax,
right,
and pigments.
Well, that's when I was an illustrator and a photographer, I was using Photoshop and computer and all these very high-tech devices to create my work. And I think that one of the primary things that attracted me to encaustic was this notion of getting rid of all that technical stuff and just going back to this pure form of making a mark and doing artwork with it. And once you see the paintings, the surface quality is so luscious and seductive that it's just a wonderful medium to work in. But you're right, I think it's very analog, as opposed to high tech. I mean, there are some contemporary artists that do very high tech things with it, but I think basically it's just a very primitive medium to work in.
When I first started doing this show many years ago, I had an artist, a Native American potter, who talked about responding to the clay and being receptive to the clay and having the clay teach you as opposed to trying to master it and get it to do what you want it to do. He said that never worked. You had to really it was almost like a relationship. And when I was looking at your work yesterday, I just thought, I bet there's something like that going on with it.
You're absolutely right. In fact, when I first started using encaustic, I was really frustrated. And I think most artists that will attempt to use the medium, it's a pretty steep learning curve because it doesn't react like oil or acrylic because of the heat. So the medium tends to sort of push you in different ways of working. I like to say that it's like a journey without a map. I'm never quite sure where the painting's going to end up. But that's another thing I really love about it. If there's a spontaneity and a way to work with the material that is wonderful, and that you can build up the surface and then you can scratch back down into the surface and reveal things underneath. I like to kind of say it's an archaeology of painting when you look at the work.
Well, you can build up and build up and then scratch away or melt away things that are already there.
Right, and you have to, I've been doing it now for about 10 years, and you have to kind of know how much you're going to be able to see after you put 3 or 4 or 5, 10 layers of the medium on there. Some of that stuff underneath is completely opaque and you can't see it anymore, but I still know it's there, which is kind of fun. So,
you are in a show that we talked about a little bit earlier in the year called Mining the Unconscious. You have a triptych in that show called The Fountain, which is an encaustic work, and I think in the way that you describe the process, there's a lot of, it seems like there's a lot of room for your unconscious mind to do its work, for things to be hidden, to be revealed, and for discoveries to be made.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, when you look at some of the very famous encaustic painters, obviously, I guess the most famous is Jasper Johns. You know, everybody was always looking at his paintings, trying to figure out the puzzle, the riddle, because his work's very mysterious and seems to come directly from his subconscious. Plus, he never talks about his, you know, his work, so it makes it even harder to understand. But I think the medium lends itself to that. It's very tactile. I mean, you can sculpt with it. That piece that you're referring to, the fountain, it's a very three-dimensional sculptural piece, and I love the way that you can use the medium to build up these forms. It doesn't have to be flat like a most traditional painting. You can really become more sculptural with it, which is great. So,
does the encaustic medium suggest subjects? Because I noticed when I was going through one of the books of your work that there's so many different kinds of things. There's flowers, there's star patterns, there's dinosaurs, there's faces, there's spines that look like snakes. I mean, literally spines made of bone, in which you have incorporated actual bone found in the desert kind of thing. But how do you come up with the subjects of your paintings, which are all one, it's, they're not just abstract works, they are all figures of one kind or another?
Boy, that's a tough one. I think I'm just drawn to those subjects, nature and science, technology. I don't know that encaustic, the medium itself, is the makes those subjects more prominent or but I there seems to be a tendency for a lot of encaustic artists, and this is interesting because I went to a conference in Boston, and there was sort of this discussion between the East Coast and the West Coast artists that work in encaustic, that the West Coast, the Southwest, is a lot more nature, painterly, outdoor, because of the quality of light here, and I think it maybe holds true for a lot of the artists that work out here. And the painters that work in the East Coast are more internal. You know, their work is, whether it's abstract or not, it seems to be more about their internal struggles and things that are going on. And I think maybe being in a big city, that must have an
You don't really want to go outdoors if you
Yeah, right. But, you know, Leonard Cohen had a great quote. He said, if I knew where the ideas came from, I'd go there a lot more often.
Yeah, right. Now, there is an encaustic institute, and you give classes and workshops and things like that.
Right. We started that. There was a group of encaustic artists that got together about, gosh, 3 or 4 years ago, called New Mexico Wax. And it gradually grew into the Encaustic Art Institute with the help of Douglas Marin, who has a studio right on Highway 14 out near Cerrillos. And he decided to donate this pyramid studio that he has and make it a nonprofit. And we have shows. In fact, there's an opening on Saturday. It's the third part of the Mining the Unconscious show, and it's all encaustic art. And we have workshops and lectures, visiting artists, and it's great.
And people can even learn to do this technique themselves.
Exactly,
if they choose to.
Yeah. And I'm going to do a demonstration of the medium on Saturday the 13th, I think, is next. Is that the 13th? Next
right.
Saturday? At Vivo Gallery, if somebody wants to come by and just see a little bit about the encaustic medium, they're welcome to come by. It's free, and it'll start at noon.
Meanwhile, the opening is this Friday, the 3rd of August. The show runs through August 24th. Russell Thurston is an encaustic artist, and his show is called Earthly Delights. And Ann Laser is the other artist who will be there, and she's got a bunch of works as well. Vivo Gallery, 725 Canyon Road, at vivocontemporary.com. Now, what is the website for the Encaustic Art Institute? Or they can just Google it, I suppose.
Yeah, it's just the initials. It's EAINM, Encaustic Art Institute, New Mexico. So just type EAINM.com.
Russell Thurston, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.